You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Polls indicate that the public's confidence in nearly all of our institutions, whether it's Congress, corporations, banks, the media, even organized religions and public schools, is at an all-time low. And can you blame them? Well, we have just passed through a decade which my guest calls the Grand Disillusionment, while many of the people who helped create the mess we're in are still in positions of power. But the problem may not just be the people in charge, it's also the mythology of how we select them. Meritocracy. Chris Hayes is host of the MSNBC program All In with Chris Hayes, which airs at 8 p.m. locally, and he's the author of a book called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. It was just released in a paperback edition by Broadway. I'm very pleased it has brought Chris Hayes back to our show. Hello.
That's great to be here.
You write that each pillar institution of our society has, over the last decade, experienced near total failure. Why do you think so much of the establishment has let us down?
I think it's a variety of factors. I think there are certain institutions that have their own dysfunctions, a kind of perfect storm of failure just happened to happen at the same time.
But weren't they the source of our success in the past?
Well, I think the main pillar ones, when you think about American capitalism, American finance, particularly American governance, I think what we've seen is the short answer to that story is the more that you concentrate power in fewer and fewer hands, the more inequality a society has, the more bound it is for failure, and that the mechanisms that we have of selecting the elite that run these institutions, which we tell ourselves is a kind of noble, open selection process, has become quite closed and quite self-reinforcing. And there's a natural tendency under those circumstances for institutions to kind of fold in on themselves, become very blinkered, incompetent, corrupt, and dysfunctional.
Well, America has experienced crises of authority before. There was Watergate and many other scandals of the Nixon administration. Going back further, the civil rights and Vietnam War era, the Great Depression, the Civil War. Do you believe that the problems of our current era are running any deeper?
Well, no, I don't think anything gets deeper than the Civil War. I think some historical perspective is in order.
But we don't have Lincoln in the White House right now.
Well, you know, we don't, although a lot of people didn't think Lincoln was Lincoln when Lincoln was in the White House. He was probably the least popular president in American history at the time that he occupied the office. So, yes, historical perspective is important. And I don't mean to talk about the current crisis of authority in a comparative sense as necessarily worse or more profound than previous ones. We're not shedding blood in the streets and hundreds of thousands of dead like the Civil War. But it has a distinctness to it that I try to characterize in the book, A. And B, the stakes are quite high, and they're high for a number of reasons. One, the stakes are high because we saw in the financial crisis how interconnected the world is and how quickly financial contagion and dysfunction or corruption or self-dealing can absolutely spread across the world. I mean, there are quite literally hundreds of millions of people around the world who are out of work and poor because of that financial crisis. I mean, there is a direct causal link between the two. And number two, we are on the precipice of facing the single greatest governing challenge human beings have ever faced on the planet, which is the challenge of curbing carbon pollution and coming up with a sustainable framework for all of us together to continue to inhabit a sustainable Earth. And unless the institutions are functioning, we are not going to be able to meet that challenge.
People aren't trusting scientists anymore either.
This is one of the negative consequences of this crisis of authority, which is that distrust tends to seep out and taint all the institutions, both guilty and not guilty. And so what you see is folks say, well, you can't trust the banks and the government, and you can't trust those scientists who are trying to hoodwink you with this climate change conspiracy.
You called Detroit the national capital of institutional collapse. Does the city provide any hints as to where we're headed as a country?
Well, I mean, the situation in Detroit is dire right now. It's dire just in a very specific way in that it is looking more and more like it may go through shortly the largest municipal bankruptcy in American history.
Although the person who has been put in charge says that's what he's trying to avoid.
Yes, and he's trying to avoid that, and many of the people on the ground in Detroit are trying to avoid that. Detroit, and Detroit obviously is a very complicated, multifaceted place, and there's incredible vibrancy and life in Detroit if you've been there recently as well. Detroit, I think, also has this symbolic hold on the American imagination, precisely because it was at a time a vision of what a noble, functioning, inclusive, and quite egalitarian American future would look like. I mean, there was a kind of principality of social democracy erected in Detroit in the post-war years, largely thanks to Walter Reuther and the United Auto Workers, that provided this vision of people able to acquire a kind of modicum of bourgeois comfort despite not having, you know, advanced degrees or being part of the professional class. And that was an incredible aspirational dream. I mean, the idea that you could work hard, get a union job, and have a second home seems ridiculous to us now. In fact, the facts bear that out. That is not really on the offing for folks that, say, just have a high school graduation, a high school degree in the current very, very inegalitarian framework of American society.
And it drew people from all over the country to Detroit.
Yeah, it was a boom.
A lot of people from the South, for example.
Yeah, and when we compare Detroit now to what is probably the closest thing to it in 21st century America, which is the triangle between Houston, Dallas, and Austin in Texas. Tremendous amount of growth there. Job growth, influx of population. And in some ways, a lot of the stuff that's happening in Texas, there's some really good news coming out of there in terms of the growth. But the kinds of jobs that are being created there, I mean, that gives you a really stark contrast to the union jobs of Detroit at its heyday and the largely service sector jobs that are being created in Texas right now.
My guest is Christopher Hayes, whose book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, has just been released in a paperback edition. One of President Obama's main goals, it seems, was to restore faith in government. Have the many scandals that the administration has gone through recently, especially the recent revelations about widespread NSA data collection of American citizens and the conflict with the press, have that hurt that goal?
I think they have. I think more. If you look at the polling on this, trust in the governmental institutions, particularly Congress, has remained low through most of the presidency. It ticked up right after the president's inauguration, you know, swept up, I think, in the natural hope for a clean break that we all had. I think
Well, he said he didn't want to have an administration that was Bush light.
That's right. And I think that what's interesting right now as we parse through, and I think it's important to distinguish between the word scandals as a collective noun, I think can obscure the vastly different scale of the alleged wrongdoing across the spectrum, from editing talking points improperly to bulk collection on every single cell phone customer in America. On the latter part, for the NSA surveillance, I think what we're seeing right now is the prism, and I use that word partly tongue-in-cheek, the prism through which people interpret the revelations that we've gotten from Edward Snowden and the 29-year-old ex-intelligence analyst. They interpret them through the framework of their pre-existing degrees of trust in institutions and authority. And so we've seen these battle lines drawn up in a fascinating way, in which you have people like Nancy Pelosi and Lindsey Graham and David Brooks and Thomas Friedman and the President of the United States basically saying, look, we can trust that this is being done with care and diligence. And you have Michael Moore and Glenn Beck and Rand Paul and John Conyers saying, we don't trust this. And that has more to do with what people bring to the story in terms of how they think about authority and institutional dysfunction.
Well, the president just recently met with Chinese leaders, and now Snowden's latest revelations about hacking Chinese computers gives the Chinese the opportunity to say, well, when you accuse us of that sort of thing, aren't you doing the same sort of thing? It just seems like one thing is piling on top of the other making the situation worse.
Yeah, there has been a kind of grim momentum to the revelations, and these revelations coming on top of previous revelations about subpoenaing the records of journalists and on top of the IRS targeting story, et cetera. With respect to China, I mean, I think there is a very fascinating geopolitical game being played out as we speak over Edward Snowden and what kind of card he's trying to play to keep himself out of prison, which I understand why he would want to do that. But also the what is increasingly clearly a quite high-level escalating cyber war between the U.S. and China. We have more and more revelations about Chinese hacking of both American state enterprises, but also private governments. Private companies,
which they deny.
Which they deny, but I think we have. They deny it, but we have got some pretty good evidence. At the same time, it's quite clear that we have developed an incredible array of offensive capabilities and are likely doing the same thing.
So the public sees this as, well, they're spying on us. We spy on them. That's something we all understand.
Yeah, I think that to me, the big distinction in this specific area is the distinction between spying and wreaking havoc or sabotage. And there's spying, of course, has been going on since human beings had governments. But far more troubling is the idea of cyber attacks that produce actual physical harm.
New York Times columnist David Brooks wrote earlier this week, quote, "For society to function well, there have to be basic levels of trust and cooperation, a respect for institutions, and deference to common procedures. By deciding to unilaterally leak secret NSA documents, Snowden has betrayed all of those things." What do you think of that argument?
I love that column because when I wrote the book, I talk about a division between – that doesn't isn't a left-right division, but between what I call institutionalists and what I call insurrectionists. And I think it's one of the most fascinating divisions in our current social and political life. Institutionalists are people who articulate precisely what David Brooks articulated in that column. And in fact, in the book, I say David Brooks is the absolute, the most thorough and in many ways eloquent voice of institutionalism. And institutionalism carries with it a belief that if you do not trust institutions, if you, society has no central repositories of authority, then you descend into a chaotic maelstrom of war of all against all and mob violence, and everyone takes the rule of law into their own hands. And I think insurrectionists are people who are disposed to view institutions, institutional authority, and authority in general skeptically because they understand that often it is abused.
Well, in the case of Snowden, he seemed to be perfectly happy working within the institutions, but now he's helped perpetuate further distrust of our institutions.
Well, I think he went on a journey from an institutionalist to being an insurrectionist. I think by his own telling, and again, I've never met the man, I've never interviewed him myself, I'm working off of what everyone else is working off of. He went from a journey of being disposed to trust what he was told to believe to seeing it up close and coming to deeply distrust it.
So is he part of a cultural moment that maybe goes back to Bradley Manning and Julian Assange?
I think he's part of a cultural moment in the sense that this kind of insurrectionism is a growing force in American social life, and it's stoked by it. It fits nicely with, I think, the kind of anti-authoritarian culture of hackers and of people that spend a lot of time in the subculture of the internet and working on computers.
Well, you write in this book, if Julian Assange did not exist, we would have to invent him.
Well, he's a kind of perfect symbol of our worst fears of what insurrectionism would look like, this kind of gleeful destruction of the institutions we hold dear, the unveiling the mask of power no matter the consequences. And I think he embodies something about our times because at this moment in time, so many people have so little trust in these institutions.
And the institutions also is represented by the elites that you're writing about in this book.
Yeah. I mean, those tend to be the people at the highest heights of the command of these institutions.
Christopher Hayes's book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, has just been released in a paperback edition by Broadway Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Christopher Hayes, whose New York Times bestseller, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, has just been released in a paperback edition by Broadway Books. You write that next to freedom, there's probably no more contested word in the American political vocabulary than elite. Why is that?
I think it's because the in the last 30 to 40 years, conservatives have figured out a way to channel a kind of populist rhetoric that has a very powerful resonance in American life, but to change and doing so have changed the traditional understanding of who the elite are.
We used to think elite meant the people who are richer than we are. Now it's the people who are, according to the conservatives, who think they know better than we
do. That's right. That elite is defined by a set of tastes in consumption, like driving Priuses or drinking wine as opposed to beer, or elite is defined by solely by being bound up in academia, which can be a signifier of elite status, certainly, as opposed to the very simple, straightforward way that elite and eliteness has been understood for literally centuries, which is a relatively small group of people within a society who wield disproportionate power and influence, right? That is the key definitional trait of what makes someone elite.
But what about elitists, the elite themselves? Do they see them that way? Don't they often, some of the most powerful people, see themselves as outsiders?
Absolutely. And it's one of the pathologies that the meritocracy and the way that we structure elite selection in this country stokes. I mean, Roger Ailes is my favorite example. You know,
saying that because you work for MSNBC.
No, I'm not saying that because I work for MSNBC. Look, let me also say this. I mean, I host a cable news show every night. I am a member of the elite as well. I'm not doing this without some self-awareness. Roger Ailes, you know, all the profiles of him and everything we know about him is that he really does view himself genuinely as an outsider, as an underdog, as someone who isn't part of the champagne and cheese set.
Is part of the problem that our elites sometimes fail or that they never seem to be held accountable for their actions if they do fail?
I think accountability to me is one of the real watchwords of – it gets to the core of the betrayal that so many people feel at the end of the last 10 to 12 years, which is that there was a great story on Gawker the other day. John Cook wrote up a guy in Minnesota who is going to do prison time for signing his name to a loan document that stated his income. It was a no income, no job ninja, okay? A no income, no job application for a mortgage in which he signed at the signing. He signed a bunch of papers, and one of the things he signed was something stating his income, which overstated his income. This guy's going to go to jail for this, okay? This is just some poor schlub. And when you look around American society and you see basically not a single banker is doing serious time in prison for a rigged, corrupt financial system that, as I said before, has caused global misery. And this dude in Minnesota is going to go and do prison time for signing his name to a loan. There is such a profound inequality of accountability in the way this country metes out justice, punishment, and calls people to account. It makes it very hard to have faith in the basic validity of the social contract.
Well, you're right. The members of today's elite have never been farther from the median worker and closer, in the literal sense, to their fellow meritocrats.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Well, what we've seen is there's a geographical dimension to this, which is that people with advanced degrees and lots of money are clustering in smaller and smaller places. They're clustering a lot here in New York City, actually. We've seen New York City is the ground zero for this in many ways. Just contained within these five boroughs is this remarkably vast distance between some of the wealthiest people in the world and some of the poorest people in the country.
Now, should it come as a surprise to us, two different things, that Edward Snowden and Bradley Manning are both millennials and that Occupy and Tea Party movements, at least in theory, are leaderless?
Yeah, I think the thing that connects all those is this ethos of insurrectionism, which is distrust of authority, both the specific authorities, but also distrust of authority itself and the way that it operates.
Left and right.
Yeah, left and right. And it's very interesting if you read the way the Tea Party organized itself. It was very self-consciously leaderless. There was this management book. It was called The Starfish and something. I can't remember the last name. But the idea was that the starfish you know, if you chop off a limb of the starfish, it regrows. That there's the organizations they were building were lateral and web-like as opposed to pyramid-like and hierarchical. And that same institutional design structure is what motivated Occupy Wall Street, particularly at its apex, where they had this massive General Assembly, they had mass democracy. And I think all of that embodies a frustration with the ways in which more hierarchical institutions, or even institutions that were designed at first to be democratic, have grown in such a fashion that they've become more and more concentrated.
But it was pointed out that one of the problems that with Occupy was that it was not hierarchical. And in the end, when everyone can have his say, you wind up just dissipating.
This is the ultimate question of institutional design. It's been plaguing people for quite a long time, which is how you balance efficiency and democracy. And it is an unresolved question. We come up with different kinds of institutions to try to find an equilibrium between those two. And I think one of the things that we've seen, and I quote this incredible social theorist Robert Michels in the book, is that there is a tendency for even the most democratic organizations, radical labor unions, to over time become more and more oligarchic, for a small cadre of people to seize more and more power. And one of the struggles in part of being a progressive, being on the left, is waging this constant battle to democratize institutions and society, because their natural resting place, their tendency, is to grow more oligarchic, is to grow towards something more hierarchical with more and more concentrated power.
Because of our belief in the meritocracy.
It's partly because of our belief, but it's partly just a fact about how institutions operate. I mean, anyone who's ever—
cream rises to the top. Isn't that the theory?
So cream rises to the top is the theoretical justification that is grafted onto a fact about the way that institutions actually develop. What we have done is we have taken this natural tendency for institutions and societies to concentrate power, and we have erected an entire mythology about why that is justified, which says that the people we happen to have at the top are there because they've gone through this meritocratic rat race and they've outcompeted and outperformed their fellows.
My guest is Christopher Hayes. His book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy, was a New York Times bestseller when it was published in hardcover. It's just been made available in paperback by Broadway Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, how responsible is the public for all of this? We reelect the people who make the decisions we don't like. For example, immigration reform just passed a hurdle this week. It's supported by large numbers of voters, but that doesn't mean it will be passed. We have the majority of Americans calling for some kind of a gun reform. We continue to shop and keep our money in places with questionable business practices. So where do we fit into this equation?
Well, I think the public— – I mean, where do we fit into this equation? In terms of our democratic processes, particularly at the federal level, we have a problem right now, which is the distance between our elected officials and citizens is large. It's a distance measured in the median wealth of members of Congress, which is several standard deviations away from the median wealth of Americans. And that distance, just in terms of the wealth of an average member of Congress and the wealth of the average American, the distance between those two has grown quite a bit over the last 40, 50 years. Okay, so there is a way in which the people we elect are not like us.
And we have a situation where some of them are describing much of the population as takers. They're the makers.
That's right.
And the rest are the takers.
And there is a kind of mythology and ideology that goes along with this sense that there are some people who are drags on society and there are some who spur it forward. But I also think, you know, we're at this real choke point where some of the institutional design of American democracy, which was designed to be in many ways anti-democratic, to put checks on the whims of the mob, has grown even more anti-democratic. The way that the Senate itself is an anti-democratic institution. When you layer atop the Senate with a supermajority 60-vote threshold for essentially any piece of legislation, you're producing something that is further and further away from actual democratic representation.
Well, the Senate is undemocratic in another way. A small state has the same number of representatives as a large state.
Right. So, but that's the first layer of it being undemocratic, and that's conceived of and designed in the Constitution. I think we should get rid of the Senate. I mean, just so that I'm clear.
And then you want to get rid of the Electoral College, I imagine.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm not scared of democracy. I think, you know, there's lots of other parliamentary democracies that function just fine. I think that
Have you been speaking to Antonin Scalia about this?
I don't think he would approve at all. But no, look, I mean, the institutional design of the country does have these kind of checks on Democratic overreach. But what has happened is anti-majoritarian checks have increased, and they've increased through these kind of procedural mechanisms, and they have increased in such a way to benefit the people who are the most powerful. And that's a very dangerous combination.
So does widespread income inequality produce worse elites?
Yes, that's in some ways the thesis of the entire book.
People with more power will find ways to subvert the system to their interest, even if they aren't qualified. But they often think that they're the smartest person in the room.
Well, that's part of the kind of self-aggrandizing mythology that is what our meritocratic system engenders. I would say that the thesis of the book, its core argument, is that when we talk about inequality in America, and we talk about it a lot, particularly on the left, mostly we talk about how it makes people at the bottom worse off, right? It leads stagnating wages and people are falling behind. The core argument this book makes is not about how inequality makes people at the bottom worse off. It's how it produces a worse caliber of elites, how it actually leads to systematically dysfunction and corruption and self-dealing. Because the further and further away people at the top are from people on the bottom, the worse the decisions they make.
Well, we have this odd situation in Congress where they're talking about immigration reform, and the Republican Party is split on it because, on the one hand, its position has pretty much been anti-immigration. And then it lost so many votes in the last election, it sees that as an untenable situation for the future. But it doesn't seem to know how to resolve the problem for itself.
It cannot. That's exactly right. It doesn't know how to resolve the problem for itself because it is torn between what the people who run the party understand must be done for political viability and what the people who currently support the party want the party to do.
And there are Democrats who go along with some of those things. Just recently, Mayor Bloomberg suggested voting against the Democrats who voted against gun control, pointed out by others that their opponents, the likely opponents, would even be more against
right.
gun control.
Well, that argument, the sort of marginal difference between two competing candidates argument.
Now, there's that whole – one of the other big issues has been the revelations about just how much tax avoidance some of our major – often our most admirable corporations will go through to not pay what most people think would be their fair share.
Yeah. I mean the news – the Apple news is pretty astounding in terms of they've come up with all kinds of very devilishly clever means of avoiding corporate taxes, including now they're issuing bonds so they could basically keep a huge amount of cash offshore and not repatriate it and have to pay taxes on it.
Is that because the elites have also lost faith in the institutions?
I think it's because there is no social the force of the social contract. A social contract works. The idea of a social contract is that it's a contract binds both parties to it. And elites have to be subject to the contract for it to be a contract in any real sense. And I think there's many ways in which we have allowed elites to essentially escape out of the terms of the social contract that we want everyone to be bound by. And so you have a different set of rules for people that have the power to create a set of rules for themselves than the people at the bottom who don't.
The White House announced yesterday that the United States will begin sending more aid to rebels in Syria after our government has concluded that the Assad regime has used chemical weapons. The Syrians are saying this is just the same sort of thing as weapons of mass destruction. The Russians are going along with them. But it's all of our allies have been making a similar claim. It'll all happen without Congress getting involved.
It's remarkable that the Democratic gulf here, and I mean small d Democratic, Congress is essentially going to allow the government to do whatever it wants here. And by that, I mean the executive. And I'm sure there's a lot of Americans that feel good about that because Congress is much less trusted than the executive. At the same time, my favorite factoid on this is the Wall Street Journal did some polling on what people want out of Syria, what they want the government to do. And this polling is not super fixed, right? People don't have very hard opinions on this. But the least popular option, 11% of people wanted to arm the rebels. 15% wanted to actually send in troops, okay? So the actual least popular thing, 11% support, is the thing that it looks like we're going to be doing with very little Democratic backlash. It's an amazing thing to behold, the way that foreign policy, and particularly military defense security policy, operates untethered from the normal rules of gravity of democratic accountability.
Chris, the subtitle of your book is America After Meritocracy, which suggests that we're heading into a post-meritocratic age. Do you think that is?
That's aspirational. That's, I mean, I think that—
Your fantasy?
My fantasy is just that this is that we reach a point in which we go about the very difficult work of redemocratizing American society. And that means a commitment, a much more central and forthright commitment to actual equality, to shrinking the social distance between elites and citizens. And that I think, is one of the major projects of our time.
What's the role of the media in all of this? Do you think that much of what's on most evening news programs every night is not the most important story?
Well, I have to put on an evening news program every night. And what I would say about that is—
Well, we often think, what is not being talked about that is important,
right,
when we decide what we're going to talk about on this show?
I think—
The underreported.
Right. I think that there is—I guess I think that the media is best when it's balancing a set of competing interests about being— dynamic, compelling, riveting, fascinating, informative, and also exercising editorial judgment about what is and is not important. I mean, you can do a show in which you talk about the five most important things that happened that day, and they are all fairly arcane or not particularly visual or difficult to explain or remote, and that's probably not going to be a very entertaining hour of television. You can do an hour of television in which you chase some salacious scandal, which might be a lot of fun to watch but isn't particularly informative or enlightening. And so the job of the media, you know, from time immemorial, is to write or produce stuff that people actually want to consume that actually makes them better informed.
Which is usually about a woman who's accused of killing her husband.
That's one of those poles on the spectrum.
Christopher Hayes is editor at large of The Nation, host of All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC, and his book, The Twilight of the Elites: America After Meritocracy, is now available in paperback from Broadway Books. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you. It was great.